Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
All right, greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're coming to you live, February 25th, 2007, and we have one of our favorite guests, one of our most popular guests, joining us on the phones today from Austin, Texas. Our guest will be Bob Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas, and also one of the leading analysts of U.S. media coverage of foreign policy. We certainly have a lot to talk about today, so stay tuned, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. But before we go to Bob Jensen and Media Matters, let's turn to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
When state lawmakers in California voted last year to allow telephone companies to pursue statewide video franchises, they did so after a $26 million spending binge by AT&T and Verizon. The two companies spent some $25 million on lobbying in Sacramento and made another million-plus dollars in direct campaign contributions to lawmakers. More than 90% of that largesse came from AT&T. Several states have passed statewide video franchise bills. A few others have laws which restrict the ability of local governments to make sure local cable TV providers, whether they be phone or cable companies, are serving their specific needs, and as many as 30 states may consider such legislation this year. Meanwhile, some states are considering bills that would force broadband service providers to abide by the principle of network neutrality. Legislation has been introduced in Maryland and Maine, and now a state assemblyman in California has also declared his intent to follow suit, taking inspiration from an FCC condition imposed upon the merger of AT&T and Bell South, which forces the new AT&T not to discriminate between online content providers. This new bill could spark yet another multi-million dollar lobbying war.
The process of convergence is upon us. Broadband data networks are developing to the point where they carry a multiplicity of media over a single conduit. According to Jeff Chester, founder of the Center for Digital Democracy, convergence brings with it much promise and peril. Chester's new book, Digital Destiny, New Media and the Future of Democracy, for which Bill Moyers has called him the Paul Revere of the media revolution, details how large media and telecom companies are stacking the legal and regulatory deck to make sure broadband communications are most about commerce and least about providing information to empower and engage citizens.
Really off the radar screen are these powerful technologies backed by the forces of advertising, marketing, and the deepest pockets, and I am concerned that it's their content, their messages, combined with the power of interactivity and these mass digital persuasion technologies, as they call them, that is going to, over time, shape this digital media system.
Digital Destiny carefully and thoroughly explains how media and telecom companies have insinuated themselves into the policymaking process for years, creating a synergy between government and corporations that makes resisting the hyper-commercialization of our digital media environment a difficult task.
The most powerful media lobbyists in the United States, representing the interests of all the largest media companies, are former chairs of the Federal Communications Commission. This is an agency that, by and large, has been utterly corrupted.
Chester does not hold out much hope for a legislative panacea.
It's the corporate media lobby's big bucks in power, along with their Wall Street backers, and the hold they have over both political parties that is at the core of what was corrupt in the 1996 Communications Act, and I fear will continue to be corrupt as these battles over the future of U.S. media go on.
How However, there are ways to attack the problem of corruption. Some involve engaging in policy fights to carve out nonprofit, minimally commercial space in a converged world, while others involve using market and consumer power to guarantee appropriate levels of privacy and public trust among all providers of digital media. In many respects, this will involve building community broadband infrastructure and working to establish viable business models for media systems that favor diversity and public interest over profitability. Digital Destiny is published by The New Press.
Although the U.S. Department of Justice has been pushing for nearly 2 years now for a law requiring all internet service providers to track their customers' movements online, such a bill was only introduced in Congress just this month. Among the many provisions of the so-called Safety Act is one that would allow the Justice Department to require ISPs to save online access logs forever and punish the employees of ISPs that don't comply with prison terms. And in the private sector, the makers of TiVo are now selling a new service whereby advertisers and TV networks can buy snapshots of its digital video recorder user base. However, TiVo swears that no personally identifiable information is included in the data it sells. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okey-dokey, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you live today, February 25, 2007. And it is quite a winter day here in the Midwest. And thank you for joining us today. And we're fortunate today to have a guest who we oftentimes have on the air in recorded shows. He's such a generous guest. He's willing to record programs with us. But we wanted to get him on live this week. Bob Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, frequent guest and one of the leading critics of journalism in the United States in a number of different areas. And he's worn several hats on our program. But in particular, I think he has emerged as one of the leading critics of the coverage of U.S. foreign policy in the conventional news media and the mainstream press. And that's what we're going to be talking about today on Media Matters for this hour. Bob Jensen, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, it's always great to be with you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. And let's get right down to business, because I think, you know, as we read the newspapers and watch the news and go to the websites on the Internet, we're seeing a situation in which the United States looks like it may well be at war again in the Middle East with Iran this time. And I was wondering if you would just sort of put things in context for us. What, in your view, is actually taking place, as far as you can tell, in Iran, in a nutshell? And then how would you characterize the press coverage in the U.S. news media of what's going on in Iran?
Well, the situation is obviously quite dangerous. Wherever you go, and I travel a lot, you find that people are terrified that the Bush administration is going to unleash a bombing attack against Iran. Now, what's funny is when you talk to people, everyone, and I'm not talking about foreign policy experts, I'm talking about ordinary people, everyone understands that for the United States, either by itself or in conjunction with Israel, to attack Iran would be sheer madness at this point. The Middle East is already, you know, in very, very fragile place, and to attack Iran, which is, after all, you know, a major regional power with the capacity to respond either directly against the U.S. or against U.S. forces around the world, I mean, it's literally madness. No matter what your political perspective, just from a rational point of view, for the Bush administration to unleash a bombing attack against Iran makes no sense from any perspective. Yet what you find is all over the country, and in fact all over the world, I just came back from Mexico and I found that people in Mexico were terrified of this as well. People are afraid that the Bush administration has passed a kind of point of no return, that there is now no longer a rational calculation being made. It's a political desperation at work in the Bush administration as their debacle in Iraq continues to unravel, and they look for some way to counter this. So I think a lot of people feel scared, even though we know there's no rational reason the U.S. should engage in this policy.
Well, what is the purported reason, I mean, to the extent there is one, that the United States government is giving for to justify an attack upon Iran?
Well, of course, the just like in the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the focus is on weapons. In this case, it's the Iranian nuclear program. No one is arguing Iran has a nuclear weapon, of course. It is the program and the conflict between the Iranians and various international agencies around inspections. Some of these are very legitimate questions, as they are in many places where nuclear proliferation is an issue, as they are in the existing nuclear states, which are not disarming as they should be under international protocol. So there's a lot of important questions to be asked about the spread of nuclear weapons. But just as in the run-up to the war in Iraq, we can see, I think, that this is pretext for another U.S. agenda. In other words, much like the attack on Iraq was justified in terms of what turned out to be non-existent weapons, the attack on Iran is being discussed in the context of preventing the development of nuclear weapons. But as I think we can observe from the last six decades of U.S. policy in the Middle East, that's really not the issue. The issue is about the fundamental goal of the United States over those six decades to deepen and extend its dominance over that strategically crucial region. And that's where the news media comes in, because they should be raising these questions, and sadly they're not. And I think this is really important for people to understand, that even when on the surface U.S. journalists appear to be raising critical questions, for instance, in this current situation, there are some journalists raising questions whether the U.S. evidence, so-called, about Iran is valid. Not only the evidence about Iranian nuclear development, but now corresponding evidence, so-called, about Iranian involvement in arming the insurgents or resistance forces or terrorists, whatever you want to call them, in Iraq. Is the Iranian government supplying Iraqi insurgents with sophisticated weapons? That's another question. All of this, though, is kind of a cover story for what the real goal of U.S. policy is. And when journalists don't raise that real question about U.S. goals to dominate the region, then no matter what they're reporting on the surface about these other questions, they're involved in a fundamental program of distorting the reality of the policy.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Professor Bob Jensen from the University of Texas School of Journalism, a frequent guest here on Media Matters, and an author of many books, including a new book coming out next month, Pornography and the End of Masculinity. And we'll be talking about that, I hope, in a future program. Today, our discussion is U.S. foreign policy, press coverage of it, specifically what's going on in Iraq and prospectively in Iran in the year 2007 by the United States government. Our phone number here at Media Matters at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Please do call in if you have any questions or comments for Bob Jensen. Bob, you know, this is an area you study. I mean, you were a working journalist for a long time. You've been teaching journalism for, I think, longer than either of us wants to talk about out loud. And, you know, oftentimes people will say to me when they hear an argument like that, well, what explains this? I mean, journalists are smart. I mean, how can a journalist, for example, a working journalist in this country who went through the build up to the invasion of Iraq, and it's really there's been sort of a certain amount of humiliation for working journalists in this country who covered that, or even who didn't, who participated in media that covered it, sort of an acknowledgement that there was not enough critical interrogation of claims by the government that really sort of built up popular support for this war. So people say to me, how can journalists not be more critical now? Why are they, you know, or are they being more critical now? How do you respond to that question?
Well, it's crucial, of course, to understand why journalists fail so consistently, and why they fail when we need them most. Because I think we should remember that when times of national crisis, when a nation is moving toward war, that's when we need a truly independent and critical and skeptical journalism more than ever. And that's precisely the moment when journalism fails us the most. Why is that? Well, I think there are two things we can point to very quickly. One is, of course, and your work on this has been so important, on the structure of the American news media, corporate and commercial. Not just corporate, but also commercial, for-profit, that the dominant media are all for-profit enterprises, and that structures and, in fact, constrains the capacity of journalists to operate. The second thing we need to point to, of course, is the professional practices that have emerged, especially in the post-World War II era, that have tended to create a journalism that relies way too much, a kind of almost slavish reliance on official sources, as journalists tend to become conduits for the dominant view rather than critics of that view. But here I'd like to point to another important aspect, and that's simply the American ideology. And we need to remember that American journalists are Americans. That is, they are educated in this country, and unless there's something that intervenes in that process of socializing U.S. journalists, they will adopt the dominant conventional wisdom about the role of the United States in the world. And let's remember that that conventional wisdom is that, unlike any of the other great powers in the history of the world, the United States goes forward with a unique benevolence in the world, that when it fashions policy around the world, it is not simply to expand our own influence or benefit the elites of this country, as we acknowledge the foreign policy of other great powers has done. In the United States, we have a bizarre mythology that says we are a break with history and somehow we are unique in our benevolence in foreign policy. And you can see that reflected in American journalism, that even when the United States media started critiquing the Bush administration's lies and distortions and half-truths around weapons of mass destruction and terrorist ties in Iraq, they still accepted, for the most part, whole cloth, the idea that the Bush administration really was motivated by the goal of establishing democracy in Iraq, which is as laughable as the claims about weapons. Yet the U.S. media, as it appeared to be more critical of the Bush distortions, was still accepting the dominant framework. And that's where U.S. journalism fails, and fails so deeply. It fails to ask the simple question, what really motivates U.S. policy in the Middle East?
Let me follow up just on one point you made there. I was wondering, do you think the United States is a dominant world power, is an anomaly in this regard, that its citizens regard its interests as what's good for the human rights? Or do you think that was true of Britain in the 19th century and Rome and France during its heyday? I mean, what's your sense?
Well, it's an important point. Gary Young, the really wonderful journalist at The Guardian in the UK, was just in Austin at my university speaking, and he reminded us, and it's an important corrective, that we are not the first great power that has told ourselves stories about our own benevolence. We remember, of course, the white man's burden of the British and the civilizing mission of the French. So every empire that has gone around the world destroying and aggrandizing its own power has had a story about its own nobility. That's true. I do think, however, there is something distinctive about the U.S. that has to do with the founding of the U.S. Remember that the mythology of the United States is all wrapped up in this notion that we are a break from history. We are an exception to history. The metaphor from the early days of the shining city upon the hill, the idea that the United States is a beacon to the rest of the world, the first democracy, and therefore the first nation that could go forward in the world with a truly democratic mission. I think it's the same but different. In other words, we can see the continuity between all of the rhetorics of the great powers, but also understand that the United States has always conceptualized itself as a somewhat different nation, and that does have an effect, and it is important to break. And of course, journalists, as people who claim to be critical, skeptical, and crucially independent of any other center of power, should be one of the institutions, not alone, but should be one of the institutions constantly asking this question. And unfortunately, and I say this, I always like to mention, I say this with great pain because, as you pointed out, I worked in mainstream journalism for many years. Some of my best friends are journalists still today. And many of them are really motivated by a serious commitment to the craft and to the role of journalism in democracy. Yet it is this inability to pierce the American mythology that undermines American journalism so distinctly. And you can see this at every level, from reporters at the local newspaper to the editor of the New York Times and the Washington Post, all of whom accept this mythology to some degree.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Professor Bob Jensen from the University of Texas Department of Journalism. This is a live show of Media Matters here at WILL AM 580, so please call in if you have any questions or comments for Bob Jensen. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-2255. 1-800-259-9455. And if you're wondering why my voice might sound a little different than in previous episodes of Media Matters, we're doing some monkeying around here in our remote studios trying to get an ISDN line in. So I'm on a conventional phone line today, and that probably, hopefully, is the reason why you probably think I don't sound that great. But please bear with us. I'll be hopefully on the ISDN line next week. The phone number here, as I said, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air. Urbana.
Professor McChesney,
yes,
my name is Matthew
air.
Murray, and I'm actually a blogger critic of NPR, and I'm just very interested to hear a little about your take on NPR News coverage of foreign policy, and I guess the other thing I would be curious about is I'm not really interested in spending my life forever critiquing the shortcomings of their coverage, and would love to think of or see how pressure might be brought to bear on NPR to do a better job.
Well, thank you very much, caller Bob Jensen. And is public radio immune from the problems we're talking about, since it's not a commercial enterprise?
Well, first of all, public radio, of course, as you well know, Bob, is a commercial enterprise. They do run advertising, although they call it underwriting. But, you know, public radio, by virtue of being starved of meaningful funding from the government, has been forced into the market, and they reflect that. I think NPR is a failure in so many ways. But let's first of all mention the ways it's successful. It's very good radio. I listen to All Things Considered, to Morning Edition, to some of the other programs, and they do a very good job from the point of view of the craft and the technique. Long-form radio is done best in this country on NPR. But I think we shouldn't confuse quality in style and craft with a different kind of content. And I think the caller was hinting at this, that in his evaluation, NPR often is indistinguishable from what we call the mainstream media. In fact, it is generally, I think, and should be regarded as part of the mainstream media. If you listen to the NPR reporters, they are reflecting the same worldview that you will see on CNN, Fox, NBC, ABC, and the New York Times, an acceptance of the conventional wisdom. They operate within that. I will say that sometimes NPR is willing to raise slightly more critical questions, but here, does the difference really make a difference? That is, do they challenge the fundamental framework? My experience as a longtime listener is, and reading the research available, is that they, in fact, do not, and the problem is getting worse. And the reason this matters, of course, is we have to remember NPR's initial charge was to provide a service that the market would not, that is, to provide publicly funded journalism and programming that would fill the voids that the market leaves. And it's, unfortunately, I think, largely not doing that.
What would happen, do you think, Bob Jensen, if a reporter, let's say you were hired to cover Iran as a correspondent, mm-hmm. in issue reports, or Norman Solomon, or Jeff Cohen, or any number, Amy Goodman, any number of reporters we could name, were hired by NPR to cover what's going on with the U.S. and Iran right now, sent off to do issue reports, and filed reports that basically were critical of the presupposition that the U.S. motives were benevolent,
mm-hmm.
And not imperial. What do you think that reporter could survive on NPR?
Well,
let's
take it from the beginning. Let's say that at a press conference of a government official, one were to ask a question that challenged that conventional wisdom. Well, the first thing that would happen is the answer would be evasive. No government official is going to take that on. Well, at that point, the NPR reporter, this mythical radical that you've now hired, is either going to succeed or fail based on whether other journalists in the press pool take up the question. We've seen this before. Once in a while, a rogue reporter will ask a very penetrating question, but if the rest of the press corps doesn't give it uptake, then the government official is going to be successful in avoiding the question. So, first of all, we realize that it's not the issue of a single reporter breaking through. It's a culture of journalism that is the problem. So, an NPR reporter who did break through would likely not get that kind of support. The second level, of course, is, well, what about when that story comes back to the news desk? There have to be editors who are willing to accept an alternative framework and put it on the air. That's going to be a problem. And let's say it got through to the editors, and then you've got management. And management have an eye on the bottom line, even when they are in allegedly public radio. And that means asking the question, what is this going to do to viewership? What's it going to do to our fund drive? What is it going to do to our underwriters? In other words, even if you dropped into the mix, a truly critical, independent, skeptical journalist, there's a whole system at play here. And I think that system would tend to shut down those folks. We see this even when a U.S. reporter in marginal ways tries to break out. It threatens the way the system works day to day, and usually even before the hammer can come down from some central authority, other journalists will discipline these reporters to keep them in line.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow up and finish this point you're making, let's assume that Bob Jensen gets his report on U.S. and Iran relations onto the air on NPR mm-hmm. News, and it actually is broadcast, a okay. five-minute report. What do you think the reaction would be then? I mean, what would that journalist face?
Well, the journalist would face some things right away. One is skepticism from within the organization, and one's objectivity would start to be questioned, and there would be inquiries launched. The right-wing flak machine, as it was dubbed by Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky, would kick into gear, accuracy in media, the Media Research Center, and all of a sudden you'd find yourself inundated with complaints about your lack of objectivity and your political bias. And slowly this would, you know, just erode the ability to work like this. But even more important, and I think your question hints at this, is that little five-minute report goes into a sea of journalism, a drumbeat of coverage that is proposing a fundamentally different universe. And that little five-minute report, if it is isolated, if it is not part of a flow of critique and skepticism, is going to, you know, be a drop in the bucket. It doesn't mean it wouldn't matter. It doesn't mean it wouldn't inform. It doesn't mean that certain people might not start to think about things in a different way. But, you know, media doesn't, as you well know, media doesn't work in the way that question, you know, almost supposes that a single report can change. It's the repetition over and over again, not only of certain facts, but of the frameworks and the assumptions behind those facts that tends to shape public consciousness. So we need a revolution. We may need, I hate to say, Bob, a media reform movement. Do you have any thoughts on that?
We've been talking about that in this show quite a bit.
Of course.
As a matter of fact, our guest today, Bob Jensen, professor of journalism at the Department of Journalism at University of Texas, joining us live from Austin. If you'd like to call in, the number here at Media Matters, WILLAM 580, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We have some callers who are waiting patiently. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Yes, I have a two-part question. One, can't the weapons-grade material produced by Iran's nuclear processing be removed so that they can use nuclear power? And secondly, I heard that President Bush wanted coerced testimony in the trial of energy of enemy combatants. What kind of insane communist process is that? Thank you.
Thank you, caller Bob.
Well, the technical questions around Iran's nuclear program. We know that under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as a non-nuclear state, Iran has the right to engage in the peaceful use of atomic energy. Now, many of us, of course, believe that nuclear power is a loser, but for purposes of this discussion, they have that right. And the reality is that you can't really control the way that enriched uranium is used, and once the technical means are acquired, to move from that level to weapons grade is, you know, very easy. So I think rather than ask the question, is there some sort of inspection system or some sort of regime of control that can be used to deal with this, I think we need to drop back and ask a more fundamental question, is why would a nation like Iran want nuclear weapons in the first place? And the answer is quite clear, because they've been targeted by the nuclear power of the world, the United States, a belligerent nation that has made it clear that it is willing to ignore international law and engage in aggressive war. Remember, we had an axis of evil labeled by the Bush administration, North Korea, Iraq, and Iran. And these are nations that you and I may have problems with. We may disagree with some of their policies. But independent of that, we can look at the fate of those three nations. North Korea is still a sovereign state. Iraq isn't. What's the meaningful difference between the two? North Korea had nuclear weapons, Iraq didn't. Of course, there are other differences, like the presence of oil. But the point is, if you're an Iranian leader, it is not crazy to want to acquire nuclear weapons to avoid the possibility of being invaded by the United States. In other words, if we ask the question, why would a state want nuclear weapons, then all of a sudden the framework shifts. And instead of focusing on minor questions within this country, Iran, we can look at the whole structure of the world system, and we can look at power and how it's distributed, and we can look at international law and how it is observed and not observed by different states. And again, I want to come back to this. We can look at the fundamental basis of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was that the world accepted this division between nuclear and non-nuclear states on the condition that the nuclear states would begin to disarm. And we can ask ourselves, you know, in the four decades of this treaty or so, how much action has the United States taken to disarm as the leading nuclear state? The answer is it's taken no action. And that's where the fundamental focus should be.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have a couple of callers waiting patiently, in fact, a few of them. Let's go now, if we can, to line four, Indianapolis. You're on the air with Bob Jensen. Indianapolis, are you there? Line four?
I have a couple of comments. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. You know, we have the Sean Hannitys, the Rush Limbaughs, the Greg Garrisons here in Indianapolis, the Fox News. They're always talking about the liberal media criticizing the Bush administration. I don't see your guest differentiating this type of media the way they do. And second of all, isn't it the job of members that we've elected to office in the Senate and the House to bring these issues to the American people through the media? I don't see them speaking out either.
Thank you very much, caller. Bob Jensen, I think those are two great questions.
Yeah, and let's take the second first because it's crucial, and I agree. We can't obsess about the failure of media without seeing the collapse of a broader political culture. That is, it's very important, I think, to set a critique of media in a more expansive critique of where this country is politically today, because it's not just the media that has failed, of course. It's also, let's talk about the university system, which also should be a place for critical, skeptical, independent inquiry. And as I know from direct experience, it so often isn't. I've spent my entire adult life as either a journalist or a university professor, and my sense of failure is deep of both of those institutions. But of course, it's also the political sphere itself. Elected representatives that are not responsive to movements and to people because of the power of money, concentrated wealth in this culture. That reminds us you can't talk about a political system independent of an economic system. If you want to concentrate wealth in corporate capitalism, you're going to concentrate power even in a nominally democratic system. All of this reminds us of the context and the need for a media reform movement to be part of a more general reform movement. And I was glad to see, for instance, at the Media Reform Conference in Memphis, sessions on campaign finance reform, on related reform movements that are so integral to this whole process. As far as the liberal media goes, I've always said, as have a number of commentators, that we should remember there is a way in which the dominant U.S. media are liberal in a sense. For instance, if you go into a newsroom, you will see that the individual reporters and editors on certain kinds of social issues, things like women's rights, gay rights, will be disproportionately liberal relative to the U.S. population. But there are two things we have to remember, is that on other kinds of issues, especially questions of foreign policy and the structure of the economy, surveys now show that journalists are disproportionately to the right of the general public. In other words, they are more conservative, not more liberal on those issues. And second, of course, as Herman and Chomsky remind us through their propaganda model, and as your work reminds us, Bob, it's not just the attitudes of individual journalists. It's the nature of the institution. It's the nature of the management. It's all of those other things that structure journalism in ways that individual reporters have no control over that we have to point to. So it's important to acknowledge there's a kernel of truth in the critique of the liberal media, because ordinary folks who are looking at the media and maybe don't have experience in analyzing it they see reporters who do seem to be a little more liberal. Pick up the New York Times, and it's pretty clear that the staff of the New York Times is probably more supportive of gay rights, for instance, than the American public. But we can't be misled by that one little kernel of truth to believe that the media is somehow liberal or even radical. There are people who will tell you the media is the like almost a fifth column for the Communist Party. I mean, if you get into the right-wing talk radio and blogosphere, the theories about not only liberal but radical media start to, you know, bear no relation to reality that I'm aware of.
Our guest today, Bob Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. We've got a couple of callers waiting patiently. Let's return to the phone lines. Line 3, Indianapolis. Another Indianapolis call. You're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Okay, you got me this time. I'm also from Indianapolis. I agreed with a great deal of what you said about the so-called rogue journalist who steps out of line and what the consequences would be. And I think in the interim, you may have answered at least partially, if not entirely, the question I have. However, the question I have pertains to the fact that the right-wing attack machine would grind into gear. Why the right-wing attack machine? Why not some other attack machine? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Bob, why the right-wing attack machine?
Bob, you're going to have to help me because I'm not sure I understood the thrust of this question. I mean, why the right wing? why the right wing? Let me give it a shot. Why the right wing attack machine would go after journalism? Well, I think here we should see there's a parallel right wing attack machine that's going after the universities. Now, that may seem almost counterintuitive if one believes that the media and the universities, while being places where there is some open inquiry, are basically conservative, that is, that they basically are in line with the dominant values and the dominant institutions. And I think, Bob, as someone who's worked in journalism in the university, you would probably agree that the university and the media are not hotbeds of radicalism. So why are they the focus of an attack by the right? Why isn't the right supporting this institution that supports the dominant paradigm? Well, I think the only answer I have for that is that there's kind of a logic of dominance. That is, when you control things, you want to control everything. And right now, the right controls much of the power in the United States. They control the corporate sphere almost by definition. And even with the recent elections, the midterms, they still control much of the governing mechanisms in the U.S. But when there's even a small space in a culture for dissent, as there is in the universities, and as there is in journalism, even though they are overwhelmingly conservative institutions, they do allow people to pursue critical inquiry. That's why I still have a job at the University of Texas. That's why Bob still has a job at the University of Illinois.
You know something I don't, maybe, huh?
Yeah, and so I think part of it is simply that when there's any space for critical inquiry, even if it's not very expansive, there is a logic that says destroy that space. And that's why I think you see the Media Research Center and Brent Bozell attacking a journalism that is really actually very supportive of the fundamental goals he has. It's why you see David Horowitz attacking the universities, even though in many ways they're supportive of the fundamental goals he has.
Bob, before we get back to the phone lines, and I have a couple of callers waiting patiently, let me follow up on this, because the conservative political sort of alliance, which has really dominated U.S. electoral politics since the 1980s, mm-hmm. for all intents and purposes, and has, I think, had the Democratic Party pretty much playing defensively for the most part and responding to it as it sort of set the terms of debate, it seems, from my calculation, to have fallen on hard times, not just in the 2006 election, but with the war in Iraq, and in general, its sort of future is very much up in the air. Do you think that's accurate, or and if so, is this an opening? Could there be change, or do you think this is sort of really a minor blip in the bigger train that you're describing?
Well, I think much of what you say is accurate, and as is often the case, it's a question of perspective. How far back do you step to look at what scope of history? So yes, in the short term, I think that the conservative, especially the reactionary right, is on the ropes, partly because of the imperial overreach of the Bush administration and just perhaps part of the pendulum swinging of politics. But on the other hand, I think we should recognize that they've been very successful in pushing the entire culture to the right, politically as well as socially, and that the Democrats have moved to the right with them. And so that even if they lose control over power in some formal way in the short term, in a sense they've won in that they have been so successful. And this goes back not only to the 1980s, but of course to the 1960s, to that very concerted effort by very reactionary right-wing forces to not only capture elections, but to capture the culture and to spend money on shaping that culture. And in that sense, I think the right is in some ways as strong as ever, even if there is a momentary loss of a power in certain formal settings. So in other words, I think what I would say is I'm as terrified for the future of this country and the world today as I was 2 years ago or 10 years ago. It seems to me we're headed in the wrong direction, and that direction, the speed at which we move in that direction is increased or slowed at various times, but we're still headed in the wrong direction.
Our guest, Bob Jensen. We have three callers waiting patiently. I want to get to them. If you want to call in, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Bob Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas. Let's go to line one now. Chicago, you're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Hi, thank you very much for another stimulating program. I'd like to preface by saying there's a University of Chicago professor who's had his own radio program for like 30 years. He's a big fan of David Horowitz and unabashedly campaigns very much for him on his show. It's on every weeknight. I want to mention, I think a lot of us have been failed by our education system. We have been conditioned to think that we should assume the U.S. is good, that its intentions are good, that it's misunderstood in the world. And I'm thinking that our education particularly fails people who eventually go into journalism. I went to college in the early to mid-60s. And when I came to Chicago from Peoria and ran into Central American refugees and learned a lot about what was going on, I went back to my U.S. history textbook from college to look for what was happening in the 50s. No mention of U.S. Intervention in Guatemala and overthrow of the government. No mention of Iran's overthrow. Our reporters seem to think that Iranian U.S. history started in 1979. And I read Edward Said's book, Covering Islam, which he meant in two different ways, how Islam is covered and not uncovered by the press. And Elizabeth Swift, one of the hostages, they spoke at a press conference saying they were not abused. The whole thing was a lie, but Newsweek and other publications spread the word that it was bad. There were two progressive journalists who had their own PBS shows on international affairs.
Could I ask you to draw this to
sure. Conclusion? Jonathan Quitney and Charlene Hunter Gault, whose show was called Rights and Wrongs, International Affairs, were yanked off PBS. If our journalists had a grounding in U.S. history and remember the Alamo and General Custer and all of those things were not glorified, would they be more skeptical when they ran into the pressures that they are subject to?
Thank you very much, Claire. Now, Bob, this is a question, of course, near and dear to you because you teach journalism.
Sure. And of course, I think, again, following what we've been talking about, journalism is not the only place where intellectuals, broadly defined, fail to fulfill their role as critical, skeptical, independent. The school system does too, as the caller alerted us to. I think, you know, there's another parallel in that while the systems are designed to shut down a truly critical perspective, it doesn't mean that good teaching or good journalism doesn't happen. For instance, I work politically here in Austin with a high school teacher who I'm not going to name because I don't want to get him in trouble, but he does a brilliant job of bringing this critique into the curriculum in a way that engages students. I've talked to many of his students, and they sing his praises because he's not dogmatic, he's not doctrinaire, he simply brings up the critical history that's so important. And of course, there are journalists who do that. The caller mentioned several. The question is, do we have a culture that supports them? And increasingly, I think critical journalists and critical teachers feel under the gun. And here again, we see the parallel, the attack on the so-called liberal media, the attack on the so-called liberal university. It's all designed not really to shut down everybody, because I think the critics know you can't do that without engaging in a totalitarian kind of system. But it makes it just hard enough and just enough of a struggle that most people, when facing that, will simply give up in those professions and accept the dominant framework. And I think what's so important about it, it's the insidiousness of a liberal, capitalist, pluralist democracy, which is the kind of system we live in, free and open on the surface, yet control mechanisms underneath that we have to start to understand if we're going to see why, as the caller points out, there's a fundamental miseducation process going on in this country.
Our guest, Bob Jensen, you're listening to Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Professor Bob Jensen.
Yes, Bob Jensen, nice to talk to you. You know, I would nominate for the Breaking News Investigative Reporting Award of the Year last Friday's Amy Goodman, Canada to Iran and back, the Majid family, taken off of a plane in Puerto Rico and thrown into a Corrections Corporation of America in Tyler, Texas prison. You know, the party press is the party organizer, but we have the press. We have Amy Goodman, but we don't have a party. So, you know, give me your take on that. Thank you.
Yeah, and this is a question, Bob Jensen, I wanted to ask you, too, to elaborate on, which is your sense of the Democratic Party, which is the party out of power, mm-hmm. who's out of the White House, as an oppositional force in American politics.
Well, I personally don't think the Democratic Party is serving that function, nor do I think it will in any foreseeable future. And while I do think that there are difficult questions to ask about any election, who does one support depends not only on who's running, of course, but what are the conditions on the ground in not only in this country but in the world at that moment. But at this point, I believe it's actually very important to abandon any notion of the Democratic Party as oppositional. It's oppositional to the Republicans, but it's not oppositional to me in any more fundamental sense. Now, having said that, I wish I had some brilliant insight as to where people can go in the electoral process. And my gut feeling as someone who does a lot of local political organizing is that that might not be the most important question right now. That for those of us with progressive values, those of us who might consider ourselves on the left, it may be that this is a period in which we need to build those grassroots institutions, build a truly oppositional culture, and importantly build community, that is a deeper sense of connection to each other at the local level that is outside of the electoral system. I don't want to say that I think elections never matter. They do, and often, especially at the local level, they matter quite a bit. But I think the energy we put into either a specific election or into electoral politics more generally has to be conditioned on a rather harsh assessment of what's really possible there. And I say this on a couple of days after Barack Obama was just in Austin, Texas, and drew somewhere between 15 and 20,000 people to an auditorium. On the plus side, the energy and the interest in politics that's generated by a newcomer like Barack Obama is important. On the downside, he's really, I think, not presenting any particularly progressive alternative. He is playing the game the way the game is always played in terms of big money, and I think he will not present any particularly important alternative. So,
well, Bob, let me interject here for a second, interrupt you.
Uh-huh.
You know, go back to the point you were making at the beginning of the show when you were talking about the prospective attack upon Iran or bombing mission upon Iran and how, you know, your sense is from talking to people not only in the United States but around the world but in the United States that this is something that is opposed and is considered indefensible and outrageous and something that's really unacceptable and potentially supremely disastrous for the human race. And this is something that's going to be resolved in the next year or two or three. It's not going to wait till the community activists get their job done organizing the city council in Santa Fe, New Mexico, so 30 years from now you can sort of contend for state power. Do you think it makes a difference who's president January 2009, or will pretty much the Iran policy is so deep wired into our political system, it's irrelevant which party's in power, how that policy will proceed?
Well, I don't think it's ever irrelevant in the sense that there will be no differences. There are always, if you look at the post-World War II era, there are differences in tactics and strategies sometimes between the parties. But I think it's the overall thrust of policy that we should remember. Let me give you a quote from a president. This is the doctrine proposed by one of our presidents. Quote, an attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force. Now, that could have been a statement easily made by the Bush administration, by the Clinton administration, by the first Bush administration, by Reagan. In fact, it's the so-called Carter Doctrine. It's the doctrine outlined by President Jimmy Carter in the State of the Union Address in 1980. Now, there we have probably the president in the post-World War II era who had the greatest commitment to some conception of human rights, yet he articulated the doctrine of U.S. control in the Middle East and, in fact, pursued it, that was indistinguishable from any other U.S. president. That doesn't mean that who's in the White House never matters. The Bush administration, I think, represents a kind of a rogue element of the power structure, and in this particular moment, a very desperate rogue element that seems to be unhinged from any rational assessment of policy, and that can be very bad. That's why I argued in 2004, as many people did who consider themselves left or progressive, that the threat posed by this particular administration in the short term was dramatic enough that one should support even a candidate like John Kerry in swing states. You know, I articulated that, as did many other people. I'm not so sure that I would make that same argument for the 2008 election. I'm not sure the difference between any of the Republican and Democratic candidates, and more importantly, the forces they represent, I don't believe there's a difference that's really meaningful enough for people who consider themselves left or progressive to put energy into that. Now, again, I think a lot can happen between now and then, and I'm willing to be proved wrong and try to stay open as conditions on the ground change, because we do live in a very volatile and a very dangerous time. But at this point, I hate to say it, but the dime's worth a difference phrase does come to mind pretty quickly these days.
Our guest, Bob Jensen, on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. We do have phone lines open. Time for one more caller if you want to call in at 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Bob Jensen, one of the big stories in international journalism, U.S. coverage of the world, has been the really dramatic decline in the number of foreign reporters and foreign correspondents employed by U.S. news media who are operate overseas and report back to the United States on the world. Just last week, a week ago today, the Washington Post ran a major story on this. And I don't have the figures off the top of my head, except to say that they're really quite astounding. The number of people covering the world by U.S. news media has fallen by at least 50 or 60% in the last decade, and maybe 75% in the last two decades. Does this really matter? I mean, if everyone's buying into the ideology, is this really, who cares? Or is this an important issue in your mind?
Well, I think it's part of the puzzle. Certainly, the presence of U.S. journalists abroad doesn't guarantee the kind of coverage that the U.S. public needs to truly understand. And I think that's, by the way, as a kind of a footnote, that's why so many people have, in the Internet age, have found themselves moving toward foreign news sources. I mean, how many people do you know who read The Guardian or The Independent in London or read English-language press from South Asia or something? You know, I know scores of people doing this now because the U.S. coverage of the world is so inadequate. So it's not that more journalists from the U.S. around the world would automatically in, you know, result in better coverage. But I think it's part of this slow, almost degradation of the craft of journalism. And I think you and I might agree on this, Bob, that whatever the problems of American journalism, there is a kind of craft there that has at its core the notion of journalists being independent. And when you erode any aspect of that by reducing foreign bureaus, by essentially saying the rest of the world doesn't matter enough to cover, then there's kind of, it's like one more body blow to journalism. And I think it's a function of efficiency and bottom line profit motives. There's no really no dispute about why they cut these bureaus. It's because it cuts costs. And so I don't think it has a dramatic effect on the quality of foreign news, but it certainly doesn't help, and it does sort of lead to this slow devolution of journalism into nothing more, in some cases, than headline news services and news about Britney Spears.
We've got only a couple minutes left, and we have two callers who just called in. I'll try to get to both of them. I want to ask each of them to be extremely brief with their question, if they can. Let's go first to Urbana, line one. You're on the air with Professor Bob Jensen.
Thank you very much. Just a quick question. I'm so disturbed by the conservative media and it's the extreme mean-spirited quality that you know seems to pervade this medium. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, we don't want to pretend that political interaction has ever been particularly polite, either in the U.S. or around the world. Part of politics is a kind of rough and tumble engagement, but there is an almost pathological mean-spiritedness to the right-wing attack media. We see this both in the way they speak, the ugly, often racist and sexist terms used, as well as the general contempt for anybody who has an opposing point of view. I've been on a lot of these shows. I've experienced it, and it certainly doesn't add to the quality of political dialogue in this country.
Let's go now to our final caller, line four, Chicago. You're on the air with Bob Jensen.
Former Press Secretary Lyndon Johnson stated that the job of the president is more than one person can handle. And we've seen the capacity overload, and extending our range in diplomatic areas throughout the world. And the question should be revisited in the light of election and so forth. Is there more than we can think of in terms of leading the country than just in the hands of a president? It's just gotten more than any one person seems to be able to handle. But with oversight on this group and that group, the cabinet is not enough. So I think a question should be raised as democracy with one president, the best solution we can think of. I hang up and thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Bob Jensen, sort of put on your constitutional law, democratic theory.
Oh,
yeah.
Goodness.
What do you think? Should we revisit the entire structure and maybe rethink the presidential position?
Well, I think I'm, of course, not silly enough to pretend I have answers, but I do think the question is maybe an appropriate place to end because it reminds us that there are some really big questions about the future. The two-party system based in a presidential system is pretty clearly a failure. Would a parliamentary system, much like Western Europe, work better? A lot of us think it would. Winner-take-all voting, a disaster. The Electoral College, a disaster. All sorts of anti-democratic features to this system that are going to have to be revisited. When are we going to be able to take on those big questions? Right now, people see them as too big to handle. But I think we're coming to a point very clearly as the system continues to break down where these questions are going to be on the board in a very direct and very meaningful way.
Bob Jensen, I want to thank you so much for taking an hour out of your busy schedule this Sunday to join us here on Media Matters, WILL AM 580. Thanks again. And we'll have you back on the air soon, I hope, and often.
Okay.
And I want to, again, thanks again, Bob, for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. It's a great show with great callers. I appreciate it. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah, I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, who works hard to get all this together. And thank Norman Stockwell up in Madison, Wisconsin at WRT, who's done his part to make the remote studio work well. I'm Bob McChesney, and I'll be back in 167 hours with another guest here on WILL AM 580. Thank you all very much, and have a good week.